Hi, Dick Emery here. This is For the Record program number 831, titled The Elderly, quote, wouldn't be effing helpless if you weren't sending them effing checks to sit on their A-blank-blank and lay in hospitals all day, unquote. The GOP's assault on Social Security. This is being recorded on January 23rd of the year 2014. The highly off-color quote with which that is in the title of the program and that I necessarily had to attenuate because of the, we're on the radio, and you just can't say those nasty things on the radio, can you now, Charlotte? Nope, you most assuredly cannot. That is a verbatim quote from Edward Snowden, everybody's wonderful hero, the guy I call Eddie the Friendly Spook, and the individual to whom I will refer as the Peach Fuzz Fascist. We have discussed this before very quickly. That verbatim quote was from the Ars Technica website or chat group that Eddie Snowden was frequenting in 2009 when he was stationed in Geneva, Switzerland, and working for the CIA. Edward Snowden is an extreme right-winger, as are all the people around him, although many of them have different covers, and we have spoken about this in numerous programs. This broadcast is going to be one of those programs in which it will be essential to use the written description for the show. For the Record is something of a hybrid media experience. It is meant to be read as well as listened to. And this is a very good example because due to the limitations of time, we simply won't have the time we need to go into the subject material in as great a length as it needs to be examined. Very quickly, among the many media sources for information about Edward Snowden, an article in the New Republic of January 19th of 2014, which in turn was taken from directly from Edward Snowden's online chatting when he was in Geneva working for CIA, in addition to that wonderful quote, the elderly, quote, wouldn't be effing helpless if you weren't sending them effing checks to sit on their A-blank-blank and lay in hospitals all day. Snowden observed, magically, the world changed after the New Deal, and people, the old people, became made of glass. And in an article from the Ars Technica blog of June 26th of 2013, Joe Mullen, M-U-L-L-I-N. In 2009, Ed Snowden said leakers should be shot. Then he became one. And Snowden also was opining. As for those who didn't agree with him about the rightness of the gold standard or the need to eliminate Social Security, they weren't just mistaken. They were, quote, retards, unquote. Also noting, as something that we have talked about before, NBC News of May 28th of 2014, we've spoken about this in previous programs, including For the Record 829. There is a post by Tracy Connor, C-O-N-N-O-R, and from an interview with Brian Williams, Inside the Mind of Edward Snowden. And again, for those people who are maybe shocked or puzzled by what I'm saying about Snowden, who has been anointed by the media as something of a latter-day saint, no pun intended, Snowden was quoted, I was trained as a spy in sort of the traditional sense of the word, in that I lived and worked undercover overseas, pretending to work in a job that I'm not, bad English, and even being assigned a name that was not mine. Again, I was trained as a spy in sort of the traditional sense of the word, in that I lived and worked undercover overseas, pretending to work in a job that I'm not. Edward Snowden is a spy, and spy rhymes with lie. We don't have time to go into the Snowden WikiLeaks op, and those are both intelligence, mega intelligence operations that are essentially one and the same. We have gone into that at great length if one examines the various individuals involved in this, from WikiLeaks to Glenn Greenwald to Snowden himself. None of their actions really makes sense if you stop to think about it, unless you look at it in terms of what it bloody well was and is, which is a PSYOP, an underground Reich PSYOP. I think the whip hand is in all likelihood BND, German intelligence. I think there is a very important element of CIA involved as well. And among the victims, the Obama administration, U.S. foreign policy, American high-tech business, and the NSA and the GCHQ itself. There are other victims as well. And some of those victims are Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea, i.e., you and I. In 829, one of the things that I spoke about was my opinion that one of the major goals of the Snowden op was to alienate young Americans, the type of idealistic young adults who elevated Barack Obama in the 2008 election. And as we looked at in the, in For the Record 829, and it is in the description for this show as well, the group of young adults 34 and under, 70% of those adults view Edward Snowden positively. And those are many of the people who stayed home in 2014. Off-year elections generally have very low turnout, and the Republican dominated 114th Congress was elected by roughly 42% of the eligible voters, or with participation in the election by 42% of the eligible voters. And on the very first day of the 114th Congress, they began their attack on, you guessed it, Social Security, the very thing that Edward Snowden was railing against in his post. By the way, he also has been, not his post, but in the chat group, he also is advocating a return to the gold standard, like his political idol Ron Paul, to whose campaign he contributed in 2012. Long story made short, if we were to return to the gold standard, among the very first immediate results of that would be a collapse of the global economy. And for the record, 756, we took a look at the affinity of Ed Snowden for Ron Paul and for his son Rand Paul, and we looked at Julian Assange's idolization of both of them as well. Plus, it was Rand Paul, Ron Paul's son, a Republican senator from Kentucky who is very close to the Koch brothers and has been schmoozing with Rupert Murdoch. Also, the presidential candidate of choice of none other than Ralph Nader. Rand Paul appears to have been the person who introduced Bruce Fein, the top legal advisor to Ron Paul's presidential campaign, to the Snowden family. It was Bruce Fein, who was Eddie Snowden's first attorney and is the attorney for the Snowden family. There are many more articles in this program than I'm going to have time to read, so I will simply annotate those and do my best to sum up the discussion. Some very good work is being done by Dylan Scott, S-C-O-T-T, on the Talking Point Memo blog, and also some very good work on the GOP attack on Social Security being done by Michael Hiltzik, H-I-L-T-Z-I-K, of the L.A. Times, and we're going to be talking about their work. To make a long story short, the acceleration of the number of Social Security disability recipients has placed the Social Security Disability Fund in relatively tight straits, and without slightly adjusting funds from the regular old age benefits program, something that has been done 11 times previously, most recently in 1994. The disability program may be going, will be in tough shape in late 2016. In fact, it would take a very minor shift of funds, the type of thing that has been done 11 times previously, to remedy the problem. However, the Republican Congress is talking about basically holding that hostage in order to revamp the Social Security program, thereby cutting benefits. And one of the people who is leading the GOP charge is none other than Rand Paul, part of what I call the Palestinian Libertarian Organization in, for the record, 756. And again, the Palestinians and Eddie Snowden are very, very close indeed. Michael Hiltzik, again, of the L.A. Times, last name H-I-L-T-Z-I-K. I may be mispronouncing that slightly. From January 19th of 2014, Rand Paul steps up the GOP attack on Social Security. He writes, "Travel obligations kept me from addressing until now the attack on Social Security disability recipients made last week by Senator Rand Paul, Republican of Kentucky, but it was too outstandingly ignorant and cynical to go unanswered. Long story made short, if Paul's words truly represent the Republican Party's approach to Social Security, then not just the disabled, but everyone else with an interest in the program, taxpayers, retirees, and their survivors and dependents should start panicking now. We reported on the first shot fired at Social Security by the new GOP Congress here. Paul has now raised the stakes. On day one, the new Congress launched an attack on Social Security. Here are Rand Paul's words delivered to an appreciative audience on Wednesday in the key presidential primary state of New Hampshire. The thing is that all of these programs, there's always somebody who's deserving, but everybody in this room knows somebody who's gaming the system. I tell people that if you look like me and you hop out of your truck, you shouldn't be getting a disability check. Over half the people on disability are either anxious or their back hurts. Join the club. Who doesn't get up a little anxious for work every day and their back hurts? Everyone over 40 has a back pain," unquote. Rand Paul thus associates himself with a slander of disability recipients favored by Republican conservatives, albeit abetted, I should say, by ill-informed journalists who include the staffs of NPR and 60 Minutes. We reported earlier on the latter's abandonment of journalistic standards in its disability coverage. Leaving aside Paul's contempt for people suffering from these conditions, join the club, unquote, his numbers are flagrantly wrong. The actual figures can be found in this table from the Social Security Administration. Start with, quote, anxiety, unquote. The Social Security Administration classifies anxiety as a subset of mental disorders and places it in the catch-all category of, quote, other, unquote, which constitute a total of 3.9% of all Social Security disability claims, and that's all otherwise unclassified mental disorders, not just anxiety. Social Security doesn't regard anxiety as lightly as Rand Paul. According to its definitions, which can be found here, the category includes post-traumatic stress syndrome and phobias, or compulsions that result in marked difficulties, unquote, with working or living in society, or, quote, complete inability to function independently outside the area of one's home, unquote. Paul wants his audience to think of, quote, anxiety, unquote, as the mild sense of dread you might experience when contemplating a bad day at work or perhaps an unpleasant visit with your family. He is lying. As for back pain, no one gets disability for the kind of mild stiffness that Bayer Aspirin claims to relieve in its TV ads. That's the condition Paul tries to evoke by saying, quote, everyone over 40 has a back pain, unquote. But he shows no empathy whatsoever for the real sufferers of this condition, those who get it not from laboring in the physician's office or in Congress, as Paul has, but from years of hard physical toil or workplace injury. Social Security classifies back pain as a, quote, disease of the musculoskeletal system, unquote. Some 30.5% of disabled workers fall into this category in 2013, according to the latest available figures. But that category covers a lot more than, quote, back pain, unquote. It also comprises amputations, joint failures, leg and arm fractures, spine disorders, and burns. These are the official figures. No one has documented any others. Paul didn't cite a single source for his assertion that, quote, over half the people on disability are either anxious or their back hurts, unquote, so it's reasonable to conclude that he has no sources whatsoever. But that's all right, because his goal isn't to offer a considered analysis of the pressures facing Social Security in general or its disability component in particular, but to rationalize an attack on the whole program by ridiculing disability recipients as a step toward legislating their benefits out of the system. Fabricated statistics are more useful, or more than useful, for that purpose. The disability program is facing a fiscal crisis that could force a cutback in disability payments of about 20% starting next year. Paul and other Republicans have signaled that they won't accept the customary remedy for similar situations, which involves reallocating some payroll revenues from the old age fund to cover disability's near-term shortfall. Instead, they're demanding a full-scale fiscal rebalancing of Social Security, which in practice means benefit cuts for everyone, disabled, retirees, and their families. A large proportion of Paul's own constituents would be harmed by his approach. In 2013, his home state of Kentucky had the fourth highest disability rate in the country. More than 225,000 residents, or 8.2% of the population, fostered in part by low educational attainment and lack of gainful employment opportunities. What has Paul done to alleviate those conditions? I would stress that, or add that Kentucky also has a lot of coal miners, and boy, they labor under very bad conditions, and between black lung and all sorts of other horrible things that befall coal miners, it is not surprising that Rand Paul's home state of Kentucky had the fourth highest disability rate. Continuing with Michael Hiltzik's analysis, the most cynical aspect of this attack is that it comes from some lawmakers who were helped by Social Security in their own lives. The roster includes Representative Paul Ryan, Republican of Wisconsin, who received Social Security benefits during his college years after his father's untimely death, and now thinks that the nation can't afford to keep paying them as currently scheduled. Another is Tom Reed, Republican of New York, the sponsor of the House rules change, whose father died when he was two and then was raised by a single mother on Social Security and veterans benefits. Now he talks about Social Security going, quote, bankrupt, unquote, which is flatly incorrect, and promotes a measure aimed at cutting benefits for all. This is known as climbing the ladder and pulling it up behind you. If Reed, Ryan, and Paul get their way, the only option left for the rest of us will be to hold tight. And you heard a reference in that Michael Hiltzik column to a scurrilous attack on Social Security that was on the formerly credible 60 Minutes show, a little bit about that. again by Michael Hiltzik, from October 7th of 2013 in the LA Times, 60 Minutes' Shameful Attack on the Disabled. Is it possible for a major news organization to produce a story about the Social Security Disability Program without interviewing a single disabled person or disability advocate? That's the experiment 60 Minutes conducted on Sunday, and the result was predictably ghastly. The news program's theme was that disability recipients are ripping off the taxpayer. Anchor Steve Croft, KROFT, called the program, quote, a secret welfare system ravaged by waste and fraud, unquote. His chief source was Senator Tom Coburn, an Oklahoma Republican with a documented hostility to Social Security. Coburn has a report on the disability program's purported flaws due out Monday. Good of 60 Minutes to give him some free publicity. Together, Croft and Coburn displayed a rank ignorance about the disability program, how it works, who the beneficiaries are, why there's grown. This is especially shocking because after a similarly overwrought and inaccurate, quote, investigation, unquote, of disability aired on National Public Radio in March, numerous experts came forth to set the record straight. They included 8 former Social Security commissioners, experienced analysts of the program, even the Social Security Administration's chief actuary, Steve Goss, G-O-S-S. 60 Minutes apparently talked to none of them. At the top of the segment, Croft observed that disability now serves, quote, nearly 12 million Americans, unquote, up by about 20% in the last 6 years. Coburn asked, where'd all those disabled people come from, unquote. To begin with, 12 million people aren't collecting disability payments. The number as of the end of 2012 was 10.9 million, comprising 8.8 million disabled workers and about 2 million of their family members, mostly children. The rules have grown consistently since 1980, but even though Coburn professes to be dumbfounded as to why, there is no mystery. As Goss laid out the factors, they include a 41% increase in the total population aged 20 through 64. Then there's the demographic aging of America, which has increased the prevalence of disability by 38%. In case Coburn, a physician by trade, hasn't noticed, the older you get, the more vulnerable you are to injury and illness. Then there's the entry of women into the workforce in large numbers, which has brought many of them under Social Security coverage for the first time. Finally, there's the economy. When jobs are scarce, more people land on the disability rolls, but that's not about people treating it as an alternative welfare or unemployment program, as 60 Minutes would have it. The relationship between disability and unemployment is much more nuanced. As we explained in April, disabled people always have more difficulty finding jobs than others. When desk jobs disappear and all that's left are laborers' positions, the opportunities for the physically and mentally challenged shrink. A good economy allows more disabled persons to find gainful employment and stay off the rolls. In a bad economy, that path isn't open. The most pernicious lie told about the disability program is that it's easy to obtain benefits. 60 Minutes repeated that lie. The truth is that disability standards are stringent and they're applied stringently. 2/3 of all applicants are initially denied, although 10% or so of all applicants win benefits on appeal. All in all, 41% of all applicants end up with checks. Sound easy to you? 60 Minutes interviewed 2 Social Security disability judges, Marilyn Zahm, Z-A-H-M, and Randall Fry, F-R-Y-E, who seemed to say that standards are so loose almost anyone can score. That's curious. When they were interviewed in 2009 by Zahm's hometown newspaper, the Buffalo News, they said that standards were too tight. Every month, most judges see a case that should have been paid at the first level, unquote, Fry said then. It would be interesting to see the 60 Minutes outtakes. Well, indeed. And again, 11 times in the past, funds have been transferred from the regular Social Security old age program, raised in part, in large measure by payroll taxes, to the disability program. This last happened in 1994. But what the Republicans are proposing to do now is to hold the disability program hostage until there is an overall remake of the Social Security program, including either raising taxes, which they are not going to do, or cutting benefits. There are also discussion of means testing and raising the eligibility age. And there are a number of articles in the description for the program that analyze this in some detail. Many of those are by the aforementioned Dylan Scott, who was writing for the Talking Points Memo blog. He has been doing some very good work on this, and in a TPM DC blog, an article by Dylan Scott, that's S-C-O-T-T, of course, of January 14th of 2015, Dylan Scott analyzes the GOP's 80-year war on Social Security. Now, this goes back to when Social Security was simply a proposal that was being put forward by Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the New Deal. Skipping down, this is called The 80-Year Conservative War on Social Security is Back for More, again, by Dylan Scott, 1-14-2015. Skipping down. Republicans know they have a new opportunity with the Disability Trust Fund and a leverage point that comes along once every 20 years, and they are seizing it. Price, that's Representative House Budget Chair Tom Price, Republican of Georgia, floated some favorite proposals like means testing, increasing the eligibility age, and individual accounts, otherwise known as privatization. He described it as the GOP's effort to, quote, normalize the discussion and debate about Social Security. And then skipping down, talking about the early history of the GOP opposition to Social Security, it goes back to the very beginning of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's administration. By the way, Social Security, along with workman's compensation and unemployment insurance, and the GI Bill, and the Veterans Home Loan Program, and the legalization of labor unions all took place under FDR's New Deal. And believe me, the GOP hated it. Talking about the very beginning, and by the way, we won't have time to read this entire article. It is reprinted in its entirety with links, like all of the articles have, in the description for the record 831. Initial GOP opposition, 1933 to 1935. FDR began advocating for an old age insurance program shortly after taking office in 1933. While the debate among Democrats largely centered on what form the program should take, whom it should cover, and how it should be paid for, Republicans warned that the program would, quote, impose a crushing burden on industry and labor, unquote, and, quote, establish a bureaucracy in the field of insurance in competition with private business, unquote. Republicans petitioned for the old age insurance program, what became Social Security, to be struck from the House's bill entirely, leaving a much smaller version of welfare for the elderly. Quote, never in the history of the world has any measure been brought here so insidiously designed as to prevent business recovery, to enslave workers, and to prevent any possibility of the employers providing work for the people, unquote. Representative John Tabor, Republican of New York, said, arguing against the program. In the Senate, Senator Daniel Hastings, Republican of Delaware, also moved to strike the program from the legislation, warning that it would, quote, end the progress of a great country and bring its people to the level of the average European, unquote. Social Security still passed Congress and was signed by Roosevelt in 1935, though it did not cover nearly as many people or provide the same level of benefits as the program does today. Despite the passage of Social Security, conservatives still believed that they could undo the new program. In the 1936 presidential campaign, Republican candidate Alf Landon, governor of Kansas, described Social Security as, quote, a fraud on the working man, unquote, and a cruel hoax, unquote. The Republican Party will have nothing to do with any plan that involves prying into the personal records of 26 million people, unquote, Landon said in one address. The Republican National Committee sent out mailers campaigning against it. But FDR trounced Landon and the Roosevelt administration. The succeeding Truman administration and Democrats in Congress started working on ways to expand the program toward its goal of universal coverage. When the disability program was up for debate in 1949, Republicans criticized it. They also petitioned against an increase in benefits, arguing that Social Security was intended to provide only an income floor for older Americans. Some still pushed for the program to be repealed entirely. The Old Age and Survivors Insurance Program is a grossly unsound and ineffective tool for the Social Security purposes it attempts to accomplish, unquote, Representative Carl Curtis, Republican of Nebraska, said when the 1949 amendments were still being debated. He lobbied to replace it with a program with much smaller benefits. But by 1955, with the notable assistance of Republican President Dwight Eisenhower, who called those who wanted to abolish Social Security stupid, the program as it exists today, with near universal coverage, better benefits, and a disability component, was effectively in place. In this article, Dylan Scott then goes on to trace the history of the Republican assault on Social Security. Under Ronald Reagan, as he points out, there was a concerted attempt to whittle down Social Security. Reagan was opposed to it, and there was duplicitous language that was used by Representative David Stockman, a Republican of Michigan, who was Reagan's budget director, and language was used making the whittling away by Reagan look like it was actually something for the recipients of Social Security rather than taking something away from them. The attacks then went on for years and culminated under the George W. Bush administration with attempts at privatizing Social Security. And again, all of those, this is discussed at considerable length in the article that is in the description for the record, 831. And again, I would point out that I believe that a major factor in helping to elevate the 114th Congress was the disillusionment of many of the younger idealistic voters who had elevated Barack Obama in 2008. The Snowden op appears to have been part of that. And again, Snowden is very close to the Palestinian Libertarian Organization, as I call it, and he is Eddie the Friendly Spook, the Peach Fuzz Fascist, as I call him, is opposed to Social Security and favors restoring the gold standard. In this context, before we dip back 30 years in the archives and listen to a section of, for the record, of AFA program number 10 that was reprised in, for the record, 448, we should note something about what is called eugenics. The Nazi extermination programs grew out of a euthanasia program, which in turn, and this is dealt with in Miscellaneous Archive Show M12, was an outgrowth of the international mental hygiene movement and the eugenics movement. The Law for the Protection of German Blood and Honor was basically a German adaptation of the model eugenic sterilization law that was crafted by Paul Popenoe and enacted into law in California. The Nazi extermination programs began by getting rid of, quote, useless bread gobblers, the old, the infirm, the elderly who didn't have a lot of money, people with psychiatric disorders, people with congenital disorders. And then once the people who had pulled the levers for the gas chambers had been hardened, they went on to staff many of the Nazi extermination programs. The point being that the move to get rid of useless bread gobblers did not originate with the Third Reich and is not alien to the U.S. For the record, 664 and Miscellaneous Archive Show M12, all of them available on the SpitfireList.com website for free. Go into that. And what we're going to do to close out this program is to dip back 30 years into the archives, back to July of 1985, and we're going to listen to a portion of AFA program number 10. In addition to my own voice, you will also hear the voice of my very charming and capable former co-host, Nip Tuck, who assisted me with the on-air responsibilities. And it was the opposition to Social Security, among other FDR social legislation, and to FDR's abolition of the gold standard, restoration of the gold standard, like abolition of Social Security, being things near and dear to Snowden's heart. Those were some of the things that pushed the GOP and the coup plotters of 1934 into doing what they did. And so we're going to go into, for the record, we're going to go into AFA program number 10 from July of 1985.
And it concerns a 1934 coup attempt by some of the same industrialists and financiers that had backed Hitler, Mussolini, and the fascist Japanese. They attempted to overthrow Roosevelt, Franklin D. Roosevelt, that is, because of their extreme displeasure with the New Deal. Again, this is from RFA 10, recorded on July 11th, 1985. In addition to my own voice, you will hear the voice of my very charming and capable former co-host, Nip Tuck, who assisted me with the on-air responsibilities.
Now, we're going to be reading several segments here from a book entitled Trading with the Enemy by Charles Higham, H-I-G-H-A-M. And this book is copyright 1983 from Dell. This is a paperback edition. Now, also bear in mind that Charles Higham has written another rather good book that's just come out called American Swastika, which is in hardcover at this point. It is not out in softcover, I don't believe yet, but is another fascinating book on this general vein, and both of them come highly recommended from Dave and myself. Okay, now, again, though, from trading with the enemy back to the subject of industrial cooperation with fascism, and in fact, downright industrial support for fascism in many cases. Reading from Higham's book, General Motors, under the control of the DuPont family of Delaware, played a part in collaboration comparable with Ford's General Aniline, General Aniline and Film had heavy investments in the company. Irene DuPont was the most imposing and powerful member of the clan. He was obsessed with Hitler's principles. He keenly followed the career of the future Führer in the 1920s, and on September 7, 1926, in a speech to the American Chemical Society, he advocated a race of supermen to be achieved by injecting special drugs into them in boyhood to make their characters to order. He insisted his men reach physical standards equivalent to that of a marine and have blood as pure as that in the veins of the Vikings. Despite the fact that he had Jewish blood in his own veins, his anti-Semitism matched that of Hitler.
Interrupting the text, remember that's 1926, folks, from Irene DuPont, the founder, or the main person in the DuPont family, one of the dominant families, but 1926...
Okay, between 1932 and 1939, bosses of General Motors poured $30 million into IG Farben plants with the excuse that the money could not be exported. IG Farben, for those of you who are not familiar, was the huge German chemical cartel that originally began as a combination of the dyestuffs, the various dyestuffs manufacturers in Germany, and because around the turn of the century, late 19th century, early 20th century, so much of the chemical industry was concerned with dyestuffs and their various byproducts and usages. Eventually, their control of that market led IG Farben to become one of the biggest and most important commercial chemical manufacturers wars in the entire world, and by far the most important in Germany and in Europe.
Also, IG Farben's throwing of its support to Hitler is generally regarded as one of the decisive factors in assuring his rise to power.
All right. Again, between 1932 and 1939, bosses of General Motors poured $30 million into IG Farben plants with the excuse that the money could not be exported. On several visits with Hermann Schmitz and Karl Krauch of Farben in Berlin in 1933, Wendell R. Swint, S-W-I-N-T, DuPont's foreign relations director, discovered that IG and the gigantic Krupp industrial empire had arranged for all Nazi industry to contribute 0.5% of its entire wage and salary roll to the Nazis, even before they rose to power. Thus, Swint, who testified to this effect at the 1934 munitions hearings, admitted under oath that DuPont was fully aware it was financing the Nazi Party through 0.5% of its Opel wages and salaries, as well as through its deals with IG and its building of armored cars and trucks. Simultaneously with the rise of Hitler, the DuPonts in 1933 began financing native fascist groups in America, including the anti-Semitic and anti-black American Liberty League and the organization known as Clark's Crusaders, which had 1,250,000 members in 1933. Pierre, Irene, and Lamotte DuPont and John Jacob Raskob funded the Liberty League along with Alfred P. Sloan of General Motors. The League smeared Roosevelt as a communist, claimed the president was surrounded by Jews, and, despite the fact that they were Jewish, the DuPonts smeared Semitic organizations. The connections between General Motors and the Nazi government began at the moment of Hitler's rise to power. Goering declined to annex General Motors, and indeed received with pleasure William S. Knudsen, General Motors president, who returned on October 6, 1933 to New York telling reporters that Germany was, quote, the miracle of the 20th century.
Early in 1934, Irene DuPont and Knudsen reached their explosion point over President Roosevelt. Along with friends of the Morgan Bank and General Motors, recall that the Morgan Financial Group includes DuPont Chemicals, Morgan Bank, and General Motors, beginning again, along with friends of the Morgan Bank and General Motors, certain DuPont backers financed a coup d'etat that would overthrow the president with the aid of a $3 million funded army of terrorists modeled on the fascist movement in Paris known as the Croix de Feu. Who was to be the figurehead for this ill-advised scheme, which would result in Roosevelt being forced to take orders from businessmen as part of a fascist government, or face the alternative of imprisonment and execution? DuPont men allegedly held an urgent series of meetings with the Morgans. They finally settled on one of the most popular soldiers in America, General Smedley Butler of Pennsylvania. Butler, a brave hero, had been awarded 2 Congressional Medals of Honor, and his brilliant career as Commandant of the Marine Corps had made him a legend. He would, the conspiratorial group felt, make an ideal replacement for Roosevelt if the latter proved difficult. These business chiefs found great support for their plan in Hermann Schmitz, Baron von Schroeder, and the other German members of the fraternity. Interrupting here, the fraternity is a name that Charles Higham has applied to this cozy group of German and American industrialists and financiers who formed what, I guess for lack of a better term, we could call this transatlantic financial and industrial axis that essentially was the focus of our Uncle Sam in the broadcast and which we're looking at in part tonight. So that's what Higham means here by the fraternity. Continuing, the backers of the bizarre conspiracy selected a smooth attorney, Gerald McGuire, to bring word of the plan to General Butler. McGuire agreed Butler would be the perfect choice. Butler had attacked the New Deal in public speeches. McGuire met with Butler at the latter's house in Newton Square, Pennsylvania, and in a hotel suite nearby. With great intensity, the fascist attorney delivered the scheme to the general. Butler was horrified. Although there were many things about Roosevelt he disliked, a coup d'etat amounted to treason, and Butler was nothing if not loyal to the Constitution. However, he disclosed nothing of his feelings. With masterful composure, he pretended interest and waited to hear more. When McGuire returned, it was with news of more millions and more extravagant plans, which included turning America into a dictatorship with Butler as a kind of Hitler. Once more, Butler was infuriated but kept quiet. After McGuire left on the second occasion, the general got in touch with the White House. He told Roosevelt of the entire plan. Roosevelt's state of mind can scarcely be imagined. He knew that in view of the backing from high banking sources, this matter could not be dismissed as some crackpot enterprise that had no chance of success. He was well aware of the powerful forces of fascism that could easily make America an ally of Nazism, even that early, only 1 year after Hitler had risen to power. On the other hand, Roosevelt also knew that if he were to arrest the leaders of the houses of Morgan and DuPont, it would create an unthinkable national crisis in the midst of a depression and perhaps another Wall Street crash. Not for the first or last time in his career, he was aware that there were powers greater than he in the United States. That's worth remembering here that Roosevelt was quite aware that he was not the most powerful man in the country. John Kennedy found that out the hard way. Nevertheless, the plan had to be deactivated immediately. The answer was to leak it to the press. The newspaper ran the story of the attempted coup on the front page, but generally ridiculed it as absurd and preposterous. When Thomas Lamont of the Morgan Bank arrived from Europe by steamer, he was asked by a crowd of reporters to comment. "Perfect moonshine, too utterly ridiculous to comment upon," unquote, was the reply. Roosevelt couldn't quite let the matter rest. Under pressure from liberal Democrats, he set up a special House committee to investigate. Butler begged the committee to summon the DuPonts, but the committee declined, nor would it consent to call anyone from the House of Morgan. Then Butler dropped a bombshell. He gave interviews to the press announcing that none other than General Douglas MacArthur was a party to the plot. This again was dismissed by the press, and MacArthur laughed it off. Interrupting here, MacArthur was chief of staff of the Army. That's one of the reasons this was such a bombshell. Before Niptuck continues here, note here that we have some of the most powerful financiers and industrialists in America financing a proposed military coup d'etat. This is a matter of public record, although the record has been obscured. It's worth underscoring the point here, because most Americans don't really think of the United States as a place where a military coup might take place, and our point is that this has been attempted in the past.
The committee hearings were a farce. McGuire was allowed to get away with saying that Butler had, quote, misunderstood his intentions. Other witnesses lamely made excuses, and there the matter rested. It was 4 years before the committee dared to publish its report in a white paper that was marked for, quote, restricted circulation. They were forced to admit that, quote, certain persons made an attempt to establish a fascist organization in this country. The committee was able to verify all the pertinent statements made by General Butler, unquote. This admission that the entire plan was deadly in intent was not accompanied by the imprisonment of anybody. Further investigations disclosed that over 1 million people had been guaranteed to join the scheme, and that the arms and munitions necessary would have been supplied by Remington, a DuPont subsidiary. The DuPont's fascistic behavior was seen in 1936. When Irénée DuPont used General Motors' money to finance the notorious Black Legion. This terrorist organization had as its purpose the prevention of automobile workers from unionizing. The members wore hoods and black robes with skull and crossbones. They firebombed union meetings, murdered union organizers, often by beating them to death, and dedicated their lives to destroying Jews and communists. They linked to the Ku Klux Klan. Irénée DuPont encouraged General Motors' foreman to join the Legion. In one episode, a Detroit worker, Charles Poole, was brutally murdered by a gang of Black Legionists, several of whom belonged to the sinister Wolverine Republican League of Detroit. This organization had as its members several in big business. However, their names were kept out of the papers during the Poole case trial. It was brought out at the last that at least 50 people, many of them blacks, had been butchered by the Legion, which swept through General Motors factories and had 75,000 members. At the same time, the DuPonts developed the American Liberty League, a Nazi organization whipping up hatred of blacks and Jews, love of Hitler, and loathing of the Roosevelts. Financed by L'Amo and Irénée to the tune of close to $500,000 the first year, the Liberty League had a lavish 31-room office in New York, branches in 26 colleges, and 15 subsidiary organizations nationwide that distributed 50 million copies of its Nazi pamphlets. In September 1936, while Hitler at Nuremberg expressed his grand design for the four-year plan, the DuPonts and the American Liberty League poured thousands into backing Republican Alf Landon against Roosevelt in that election. Other backers were the American Nazi Party and the German-American Bund.
Okay, now, again, before continuing with this, not only have the DuPonts and the Morgan Group attempted a coup in this country, their exposure in attempting to do that didn't back them off one bit. They proceeded to plunge wholeheartedly into the financing of American domestic American fascism. Continuing here, the attempt to launch Landon failed, which made the DuPonts hate Roosevelt even more. In outright defiance of Roosevelt's desire to improve working conditions for the average man, Knudsen of General Motors, along with the DuPonts, instituted the speed-up systems created by another prominent figure of the fraternity, Charles Bedeaux, B-E-D-A-U-X. These forced men to work at terrifying speeds on the assembly lines. Many died of the heat and the pressure, increased by fear of losing their jobs at a time when there were very few available. Irenae personally paid almost $1 million from his own pocket for armed and gas-equipped stormtroops modeled on the Gestapo to sweep through the plants and beat up anyone who proved rebellious. He hired the Pinkerton Agency to send its swarms of detectives through the whole chemicals, munitions, and automobile empire to spy on left-wingers or other malcontents. By the mid-1930s, General Motors was committed to full-scale production of trucks, armored cars, and tanks in Nazi Germany. By the way, that's the mid-1930s. Continuing, the GM board could be guaranteed to preserve political, personal, and commercial links to Hitler. Alfred P. Sloan, who rose from president of GM to chairman in 1937, paid for the National Council of Clergymen and Laymen at Asheville, North Carolina, on August 12, 1936, at which John Henry Kirby, millionaire fascist lumberman of Texas, who was prominent in the delivery of speeches in favor of Hitler. Let me read that last sentence again. Alfred P. Sloan, who rose from president of GM to chairman in 1937, paid for the National Council of Clergymen and Laymen at Asheville, North Carolina, on August 12, 1936, at which John Henry Kirby, millionaire fascist lumberman of Texas, was prominent in the delivery of speeches in favor of Hitler. Others present, delivering equally Hitlerian addresses, were Governor Eugene D. Talmadge of Georgia, his son became a senator from that state, by the way, and the Nazi Reverend Gerald L. K. Smith. Remember the name Gerald L. K. Smith, we'll come back to him. Sloan frequently visited Berlin, where he hobnobbed with Goering and Hitler. Graham K. Howard was the vice president of General Motors. Under FBI surveillance throughout his whole career with the company, he was an outright fascist who wrote a poisonous book, America and a New World Order, that peddled the line of appeasement and a virtually identical doctrine to that of Hitler in terms of free trade and the restoration of the gold standard for the United States of fascism, in which General Motors would no doubt play a prominent part. Note that he refers to the United States of fascism here.
Yes, and bear in mind, this is the same General Motors they're talking about, of whom one of their presidents, one of GM's presidents, once said, "What's good for GM is good for America." Reading on, another frequent visitor to Germany was the rugged, cheerful, hearty James D. Mooney, head of the European end of the business, directly in charge of the Atom Opel production. On December 22, 1936, in Vienna, Mooney told U.S. diplomat George Messerschmitt, who, despite his German family origin, hated Hitler, quote, "We ought to make some arrangements with Germany for the future. There is no reason why we should let our moral indignation over what happens in that country stand in the way." In other words, although the mass of Americans despised the Nazis, business must continue as usual. Messerschmitt was furious. He snapped back, "We can hardly be expected to trade with a country only so that it can get those articles which it intends to use against the peace of the world." Unquote. In a report of December 23rd to the acting Secretary of State in Washington, Messerschmitt wrote, quote, "It is curious that Mooney and Colonel Sosthenes Bain, B-E-H-N, both give this opinion. The factories owned by IT&T in Germany are running full-time and in double shifts and increasing their capacity for the simple reason that they are working almost entirely on government orders and for military equipment. The Opel works, owned by General Motors, are also working very well in the same way." That Christmas, Mooney was in Berlin for talks with Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht to discuss Germany's and America's joint future in the world of commerce. He attracted the hatred of the liberal U.S. ambassador to Germany, William E. Dodd, who returned from Berlin to New York in 1937, and referred to the fraternity, again, the author Haim's name for this grouping of industrialists, who referred to the fraternity in a shipboard press conference in New York Harbor. Dodd was quoted in the New York Times as saying, "A clique of U.S. industrialists is hell-bent to bring a fascist state to supplant our democratic government and is working closely with the fascist regimes in Germany and Italy. I have had plenty of opportunity in my post in Berlin to witness how close some of our American ruling families are to the Nazi regime. On the ship, a fellow passenger, who is a prominent executive of one of the largest financial corporations, told me point blank that he would be ready to take definite action to bring fascism into America if President Roosevelt continued his progressive policies." Unquote. Okay, now,
Again, we've talked, it may seem like we've branched off slightly in talking about participation of DuPont and GM with Nazi Germany and the Nazi war machine in Europe. But if you'll remember also, we started out talking about people like Wesley Swift and Richard Butler in Aryan Nations and William Potter Gale in Identity. And we mentioned the fact that William Potter Gale was on the staff of General Douglas MacArthur. We also mentioned that the GM and DuPont people tried to finance a coup d'etat attempt to take over the White House and either imprison or execute Franklin Roosevelt, and they approached General Smedley D., Major General Smedley D. Butler to be essentially the American Hitler and lead the military to perform this coup. Now, these two trails, William Potter Gale and his later building up of the Identity Movement and the Morgan GM DuPont-sponsored coup attempt are going to start tying together.
Okay, now, remember that General Douglas MacArthur was reportedly involved in this plot to overthrow the government of the United States. Again, this was going to be a simple military coup. Now, Smedley Butler, who was the fellow who was picked to lead that plot, testified that MacArthur was involved with the plotters, although he did testify at one point that he wasn't sure if MacArthur was aware of the plans. Still, in many other times when he gave testimony, he implicated MacArthur directly in the plot. Now, one of the things that we're going to be looking at are some of MacArthur's connections. But again, remember Douglas MacArthur's role as basically the one of the proposed agents of the DuPont Rockefeller, or the DuPont Morgan Financial Group here, okay, because that's an industrial group. That is essentially why we went into that particular group, to show that one of the most powerful alliances of financiers and industrialists in this country was openly pro-Hitler, as we've talked about in Uncle Sam and the Swastika, and that moreover they were willing to overthrow the democratic government of the United States and were very active in funding domestic fascism. Still more about the attempted coup in 1934. This is from a book called The Plot to Seize the White House by Jules Archer. It's copyrighted in 1973 by Hawthorne Books. The interview here is between Jules Archer and former Speaker of the House John McCormick, who was co-chairman of the McCormick-Dickstein Committee, the House committee set up to investigate the coup. Archer's interrogation or questioning of McCormick goes as follows. I asked McCormick what his own reactions had been to McGuire's testimony denying all of Butler's allegations. There was no doubt that General Butler was telling the truth, he replied. We believed his testimony 100%. He was a great, patriotic American in every respect. Skipping down, Jules Archer asks, had the plotters only wanted to take over the White House to restore the gold standard, or were they also out to destroy the New Deal and set up a fascist dictatorship to run the country through an American Mussolini? McCormick reflected a moment, then said, well, we were in the depths of a severe recession, and we had a good man, Roosevelt, in the White House, and he'd revived the hopes and confidence of the American people. The plotters definitely hated the New Deal because it was for the people, not for the moneyed interests, and they were willing to spend a lot of their money to dump Mr. Roosevelt out of the White House.
That again from AFA program number 10, recorded on July 11th of 1985, almost 30 years ago, in turn sampled from FTR 448 from March of 2004. Note again that one of the things the 34 coups plotters were attempting to do was to bring back the gold standard, and that was part of a long-standing Republican agenda to get rid of Social Security. That is exactly what Eddie the Friendly Spook, the Peach Fuzz Fascist, has been pushing for, getting rid of Social Security and bringing back the gold standard. This concludes For the Record program number 831. The elderly wouldn't be effing helpless if the government would stop sending them effing checks so they could sit on their A-blank-blank and lay in hospitals all day. The GOP assault on Social Security, this is being recorded on January 23rd of the year 2015. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.